Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 24, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the meaning of emptiness within the Buddhist teachings, to be empty of ignorance. This talk focuses on the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So again, this week we're talking about emptiness, or I'm talking about emptiness. And there's three suttas that are included in the article. The Kula Sanatta, the Maha Sanatta, and the this Kakayana Gata Sutta. But there's many, many, I could include probably 100 different suttas, maybe more, on the same subject. But these three tend to get to the point. And it is a very, very important point, but it relates directly to what the Buddha awakened to. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination. I'll talk about that in a moment. But this is also another very, very confusing point, even during the Buddha's time, but certainly as Buddhism has developed, the adaptations and the accommodations, the embellishments made to the idea of emptiness has made that, the modern concept of emptiness, being something that's completely contradictory to the Buddha's use of the term. The modern applications relate to a misunderstanding of anatta, meaning that instead of using the Buddha's reference to anatta, meaning that the views that we're holding of a self do not constitute a self, they're not a self. And the Buddha was using a common term of his time in a completely different way. So he was using profound communication skills, using words that people were familiar with, so that they could relate to what he was saying, but then saying, it's this and it's not that. And he spent much of his time, and this is where I get myself in trouble with a lot of modern Buddhists, talking about what it isn't, but the Buddha spent nearly as much time in his teaching career because he noticed the confusion of the people that came to the Buddha were mostly spiritual seekers who were studying with and learning from all different people, and they came to the Buddha, they were very confused. So the Buddha, out of great wisdom and compassion and out of necessity, said, no, this is what I teach and it's not that. And so I follow that. I follow how the Buddha teaches, and I know that that's important because I got caught up in all that. So the modern application of emptiness is really just a reconciliatory soup where everything fits and nothing has to be really thought out too clearly. So this environment of emptiness or nothingness is the final reconciliation for all the things that we can't directly experience in modern Buddhism, because it's taken us away from that direct experience. The Buddha taught us an Eightfold Path to have a direct experience of understanding ignorance. So let me read the sutta, and then some of what I just said hopefully will be a little more clear. The Buddha was staying at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pindika's monastery. The monk, Kakayana Gata, approached the Buddha with a question. I don't understand right view. Can you teach me how right view relates to the world? And of course, this is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. Understanding that we are stuck in wrong views and develop right view. And, you know, we developed this nicely over the past retreat. A mind can hold one thought, but that thought can be directing the mind in a direction towards ignorance, or that same thought can be directing the mind towards awakening. And that's why we need to have such clarity in what we're developing. The Buddha taught that the problem of ignorance is a requisite condition for all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering, the Buddha's words. And so his whole teachings, the whole Dhamma, is to recognize and abandon that initial ignorance. And that's the Buddha's usage, the ultimate use of the term emptiness, to empty ourselves of ignorance in a direct and mindful way. And that, again, that's the proper application of mindfulness. Another way of stating that is to empty ourselves of clinging, specifically clinging to wrong views. So it's not as much a noun as it is a verb. Emptiness is something that we do, it's not something we aspire to. And that is, as you can see, that's completely different than modern applications. And even, and again, it's not just modern applications. The Buddha talked about these differences because they were just as common to confuse people then as they are now. The Buddha responds, Kakayana, the confusion and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing views. There is the view of a permanent existence and a view of a permanent non-existence. And that's that permanent non-existence is really a reference to thinking that, and it really kind of catches a lot of different things. There were practitioners during the Buddha's time that insisted that an individual soul, this is based in part of the Vedas and later the Upanishads, that an individual possesses a permanent soul that is it, and that soul transmigrates from one life to the next life to the next life endlessly. The Buddha realized that that wasn't it. It's the first thing he said, well, it can't be that, because I'm going to find something that I can develop in this lifetime. I'm not concerned about future lives. And that idea of permanent non-existence had two or three different applications. One was the, to use a term a little bit loosely, the humanist or the materialistic view. I put my glasses on, I can see who I'm talking to. The humanistic or the materialistic view was a view that said we only have this one life, and many people would then took that to say it doesn't really matter what we do or how we live our life. We get this one life, and we're free to do anything we want with that life, including some of the more egregious things that human beings fall into. Now, other people would take that and say, well, we only have one life, and we should live it as wholesome as proper as we possibly can. But still, it's a view of annihilation. This is all we have. The Buddha taught neither one of those. He taught the middle way, which has to be developed, because a mind that's rooted in ignorance has to attach itself to something that will allow it to establish itself, at least in its own imagination. And so that's where these continued wrong views and the idea of one of the great Buddhist teachers of somewhat modern, he was around about 600 AD, was Nagarjuna. And his whole teachings, if you ever read his books, and I spent many years reading his books because I thought he had something, and he does for many people. I don't mean to that was a very denigrating way to say that. I'm sorry. He has something that inspires a lot of people. It simply confused me. And his, you can take a lot of his teachings and boil it down to this idea of emptiness. And one of his kind of statements was that things both exist and don't exist and not exist at the same time. Put your head around that and try to make sense of it. But it's a common way of explaining emptiness, and it's a common usage of reconciling a non-self characteristic, that there's no such thing as a self, which again, according to the Buddha's teaching, is another extreme view. The Buddha never said that there's no such thing as a self, and he never said that there was a permanent self. He said that what we understand when we fully develop the Dhamma and understand what the Buddha was teaching is that what we consider a self is in a constant state of becoming. And if our views are rooted in ignorance, the only thing we can become is further ignorant. If our views are rooted in wisdom, then we can continue to become wise and maintain a calm and peaceful mind. And when it's understood at that profound level, then what we think of as a self is simply a reference point to what's occurring right now. Jen brought something up that was just brilliant on the retreat, that ignorance requires time. Wisdom is outside of time. And we kind of batted that around a little bit. Lorna came up with another brilliant understanding of that. She says, an awakened human being does not age. Well, think about that. Ignorance requires a timeline in order to continue to express itself. And a fully awakened person is simply present with what's occurring. And since you have no self-reference to the past or to the future, you're not aging. That's what the Buddha means by a timeless path. It's not something that has been around forever, because that relates to emptiness. It's timeless because it takes us out of time where ignorance exists. He also calls the culmination of the path achieving the deathless state. It doesn't mean that we live forever. Just look at the Buddha. He died at 80. He didn't live forever, but yet he was an awakened human being. Yet many people insist that that's what we're aspiring to. The deathless state simply means we have ceased having the experience of aging. Of course we age. The Buddha aged. But it's no longer a concern. It's no longer a distraction. I'm no longer like Diane and I had a conversation, a brief one, about you certainly can't do the things at my age that I can do when I was 25. So maybe that's not really understanding aging, but it is. There's no reaction there. And the Buddha would refer to himself, and you know, in his younger years. It doesn't mean you don't have a reference point, but it's no longer needs to be any different than what's occurring, and that's the big difference. Let me get on with this. I didn't want to go too far, and I might not even finish the sutta tonight. There is the view of a permanent existence and a view of a permanent non-existence. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view, it is seen that non-existence does not occur. Furthermore, when the cessation of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view, it is seen that existence does not occur. Now, again, these are, you have to understand the context of the Buddha's teachings. He's talking about, as a result of wrong views or self-referential views, nama-rupa, it's through those wrong views that we establish these conditions on our existence, permanent existence or a permanent non-existence. None of those are true. We're always in a continuum of becoming as a reference point to what is occurring. The world is sustained by attachments, by clinging to conditioned thinking and wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. One who has developed right view no longer clings to attachments or fixated or conditioned thinking, or with self-obsession. It is understood, and this is the culmination of the Buddha's teaching, it is understood that stress arising is stress arising. It is understood that aging arising is simply aging arising. Referring to Lorna's or even Jen's understanding of that. It is understood that stress passing away is stress passing away. So in the moment we can look at our initial environment, what's occurring, and it might be causing a disturbance in our mind. So it's immediate to remind ourselves that whatever's occurring, no matter how agitating it's in our mind, it's because we're attached to it being different than it is, rather than understand the impermanence of all phenomena. Take a breath and relax, because it'll pass. And then it relates directly to the Buddha's description of suffering, and particularly aging, to understand that when you understand the Buddha's teachings, an ignorant human life, ignorant of Four Noble Truths, is itself suffering. And so aging is a part of that. And in being stuck in that view, when you remember that aging arises and aging passes away, a human life arises and passes away, that's just the truth, it's the truth of human existence, then we might incline our minds to the Dhamma in a much more rigorous way, thinking about Bahia, the story of Bahia. He was so concerned that he might pass away before the Buddha, before he got to Dhamma. He pleaded and pleaded and pleaded, and finally the Buddha relented and basically said, Bahia, when for you there is only the seen, what is heard there is only the heard, what is cognized only what is cognized, what is sensed there is only what is cognized, then for you there is no you here, there, or anywhere else. And then he concludes that by saying, then you are awakened. And Bahia heard those words and awakened. So the kind of the little, I can't remember the meme that I was using during the retreat, and you might hear me say it later, is move. As a reminder, the end is coming for all of us. None of us know. But we understand.
Yeah, I get it.
I'm thinking of getting some hats made with maybe a cow on it. And understood that stress arising, stress passing away, stress passing away. In this, their knowledge is, this is so important, in this their knowledge is independent of other views. The Buddha was stating very clearly that nobody has this view, at least that he was aware of, and he was a pretty bright guy. This is the Dhamma is independent of all other views. Why? Because it addresses views. It addresses wrong views specifically. This is how right view relates to the world. These last three sentences about stress arising and stress passing away, but that last is so important to remember. In this, their knowledge is independent of other views. In the Kula Sakaka Sutta that we went through just before retreat, I think it was all that week that we, no, it was one sutta. In that sutta, it's he is described as his Dhamma is an independent and fearless Dhamma. In describing how stress arises, the Buddha teaches that it is desire that fuels fear that results in stress. It's an independent and fearless Dhamma. Meaning that, I guess it takes a little fearlessness to engage in, but what it doesn't do is generate fear. It's fearless, like the Buddha's teachings on timelessness. The view that everything exists is a wrong view, and the view that nothing exists is another wrong view. And that's really very prevalent in modern Buddhism, that the goal of modern Buddhism is to achieve this state where nothing exists and to annihilate the self. There's no such thing as a self. It's just a wrong view when you read what the Buddha taught, or not just here, but everywhere in the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha continues, my Dhamma avoids all those extreme views. I teach from the middle. I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. So obviously, if you're going to engage in the Dhamma and you want to avoid extreme views, you'll develop the Eightfold Path, because that's the path that the Buddha taught to avoid, to recognize and abandon all wrong views. I was in modern Buddhism for many, many, many years. I was mentioned to Diane before about one of my root gurus, who was a wonderful man. All of those teachings, all the times I spent in meditation sessions in different temples and monasteries and 7 and 10 day sesshins, I'm not going to say I never heard Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path, but I can say all that time, I was never taught what Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path in a way that was useful to applying it. If it was mentioned at all, it was mentioned in an offhanded way, and almost as the inference and sometimes a direct comment was, this is simply a basic teaching that advanced Buddhists don't even have to concern themselves with. But mostly, it was never even taught. And when dependent origination was mentioned, it was never mentioned in the context that the Buddha taught. It was always used in a completely adapted way to mean all things are interdependent, interconnected, and in a modern word, one of the teachers today calls, we are all interbeing. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But just take the word dependent and interdependent, put them next to each other, look at them, they're two different things. Just because dependent is part of them, they don't mean the same thing. And yet, because of this need to have this reconciliatory soup where everything exists and doesn't exist, then you have to take dependent origination and say that dependent origination teaches us that we're all part of this big reconciliatory soup. We're all interdependent, interconnected, and interbe. The Buddha taught to recognize the discrete phenomena of all things that arise and passing away, including what we think is an individual self. If we don't do that, we'll never be able to recognize wrong view and let go of them. The Buddha continues, the middle way shows that suffering originates and is dependent on ignorance. Now this is another teaching of dependent origination. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition comes fabrications. Fabrications or mental fabrications are simply assumptions that we make about ourselves in relation to the world that, as the Buddha teaches, are rooted in ignorance. And we all know what assumptions take us to. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Now this is not, again, the context is so important. The Buddha is not referring to some grand cosmic consciousness that we're all part of. He never taught that. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes this consciousness, which is simply ongoing thinking rooted in that initial ignorance. From that type of thinking as a requisite condition comes name and form. Name and form, the Pali in the Sanskrit is namarupa. That's what it means, name and form. It simply means that we are now stuck in self-referential views. This is me, I've named this as me. Where is this name and form, this self-identity coming from? What's it rooted in? It's rooted in ignorance. Take the progression, use the teachings as it's presented. It's not to establish a permanent fixed self, or it's not to annihilate a self. It's simply to describe the process of rooted in ignorance, of developing confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. From name and form as a requisite condition comes a sixth sense base. Just look at the logic of this. In order for me to interpret the world through my senses, if I'm rooted in ignorance, I first have to identify myself as this is me. And so now everything that comes through contact with my senses is interpreted how? Interpreted through ignorance. So we literally cannot trust what we're seeing. And I'm talking not the Dhamma, not talking about living a life. We literally cannot trust what we're seeing in relation to the Dhamma. Why? Because our views are rooted in ignorance. If we're going to follow a Buddhist teaching, from the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact, makes sense, contact with the senses. From that contact, rooted in ignorance, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. And all of this happens outside of time. Kevin and Jen were having a talk, and it was remarkable to me that they were doing this. Anyway, Kevin came up to me and said, is this the right way to look at dependent origination, that it happens simultaneously? And that is another right way to look at it. This is not, when we develop concentration in the proper context, we can recognize this in ourselves. We can see the different steps in this, or the different links in this 12-link chain of dependencies resulting in suffering. But we can get lost in the weeds if we look for it too hard. And because this happens simultaneously, and I would say outside of time, it's very difficult to observe, but we don't have to observe it. We can understand that it is from ignorance that I ended up in suffering. From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. So now we're using something that has come through our senses. We are reacting to it from ignorance, and we're giving credence to the feeling. And so how many times do we describe ourselves as having, as our feeling? I had a bad day, or I had a bad week, or I had a bad meal, or I had this, or I had that, or you made me feel this way. Still the finger's pointed back at yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're the one that's feeling. And we're feeling that way. Those feelings are rooted in ignorance. They can't be trusted. But yet we live our lives. And on a larger scale, we run governments and we run world systems based on how we feel, rooted in ignorance. No wonder we're in such a mess today. But the mess was the same mess the Buddha was describing. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So now I've established the self. I must cling to these views in order to maintain it. Now we all know, as we start Dhamma practice, most people will have that fear that what's going to happen to me when I let go of all these views? Because it feels like annihilation. Why does it feel that way? Because we are our views. And we can't imagine a world without holding on to these views. What happens when we let go of the views? We're liberated from ignorance, that's all. We then are able to live a life as a Buddha lived his life, with a mind that is resting in equanimity no matter what's occurring. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. There's, in all the translations I've ever read, there's never a qualifier or a modifier after becoming. And it's one of those things that leads people to great confusion. In fact, that misunderstood line, creationists will say, well, here's the Buddha's talking about how we have a physical birth. Of course he's not talking about that. Start where he begins this. From ignorance, we end up here. So the proper modifier after that is from clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming further ignorant. That's the context. From becoming... and I'll add that in here, from becoming further ignorant, as a requisite condition, comes birth. That brilliance that Jen had, that ignorance requires time, it requires a timeline, or else none of this is possible. It needs that illusory, and I'm using that it's not an illusion, but it's, as the Buddha's words were, it's like an illusion, our relationship with time. It's all rooted in ignorance. There's no usefulness for time within the Dhamma because it's just a distraction. And it doesn't mean that we, as an awakened human being, we won't realize that I got to get to the doctor in 10 minutes and go out the door. That's not it. We don't become babbling idiots, but we're no longer distracted by the things of time. We're no longer attached to it because we're no longer referring to ourselves along that timeline, past, present, and future. We're simply present. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. All manner of suffering rooted in that initial ignorance. The Buddha continues, such is the origination of extreme views and the entire mass of confusion, delusion, and stress. So where does extreme views originate in? Where does suffering originate in?
Ignorance.
Ignorance. And that is the Dhamma. Most of us, by this is, and ignorance leads, you can say ignorance leads to conditioned views. We talked about that here. When Kandana heard the Four Noble Truths, he was prepared. He had a relatively broad understanding, and he just needed to hear those words. And upon his awakening, he said, all conditioned things are subject to cessation. And he's specifically referring to the conditions, the conditioned mind that arises out of ignorance. And upon his understanding that in a profound way, the Buddha declared that he was now Anakandana, the one who understands. What did he get? He understood the temporary but powerful nature of ignorance. Buddha continues, now from the remainderless fading and cessation of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. Doesn't happen automatically, does it? We need to develop an eightfold path to recognize and abandon ignorance. From the cessation of those mental fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of self-referential views, name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. It certainly doesn't mean that we lose contact. We're no longer using our sixth sense base, our six senses, five physical senses and that consciousness, thinking. In a way that is rooted in ignorance. That's what has ceased. Again, you have to keep this in the context, or you can get lost in this. Does this mean that I'm annihilated? No. It just means that ignorance has ended and you're no longer using your senses to reaffirm your own ignorance. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. Again, it doesn't mean we lose contact with the world. We cease using that our sense base and our contact through that to reaffirm ignorance. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this entire mass of suffering. Now this is the noble truth of stress. He's referring directly to the Four Noble Truths and dukkha. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. The five clinging aggregates, as we know, simply describes the ongoing personal experience of suffering. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress, that craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. And look at how that's reflected in modern Buddhism, modern spirituality. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, and letting go of that very craving. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. What is it? Precisely this noble eightfold path, right view, right resolve, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The Buddha concludes that sutta with pointing the monks and all of us right back to the path. And it's the only path the Buddha ever taught to end ignorance rooted in suffering. Upon the Buddha's awakening to that profound understanding that it is ignorance that's the cause of all human ills, he sat off and on in meditation for another 2 weeks, pondering how can I teach what I know in a way that would pierce the veil of ignorance, because he understood the profound hold that ignorance has on us. Another way of saying ignorance is deluded thinking. How would a deluded mind know that it's deluded? It needs something, it needs a framework to at least show its own delusion back to itself. That's why the Buddha taught an eightfold path. And without an eightfold path, there's no way that we can recognize and abandon ignorance. So that's my talk for today. Thank you. Since it's just us, I'll just ask Kevin if you have any questions or comments.
It's really, you know, it's very profound, and thank you for, again, explaining how that emptiness, really, what the Buddha intended for emptying and emptiness to mean.
One of the things that that is reflected in that is how the Buddha taught mindfulness. So the Buddha taught us to be mindful of what is present, what's occurring, what's present in our minds, but as equally important, to be mindful of what is not present. And again, that relates to emptiness. To be mindful of what's not present as I'm awakening, or as I'm awakened, I am now mindful that there's no more ignorance left. And the Buddha describes the quality of his mind in the Nagara Sutta and other suttas as just that. There's not a shred of ignorance left to condition how I'm experiencing my life. Did I interrupt you, Kevin? I'm sorry if I did.
No. It's, you know, interesting, as we were talking before, you know, this trip I took, it was very, you know, I think I took the path with me. You know, I was often thinking about right speech and often thinking about right mindfulness. I was meditating while I was there. And even though my visit had so much to do with the past, it was really shaded by, it was karmic, it was shaded by my current understanding, or my current, how do you state with karma, my current, it's the past experience shaded by the
present mindfulness.
Mindfulness.
Yeah,
you
what you're holding
so
in mind.
I was trying to hold things in mind, and it wasn't a constant state, it wasn't perfectly enlightened state, but there were moments of that too, and it made it more special to be there, because I was realizing how intense it was to be in that moment.
Yeah.
And it was I brought that along with me, thanks to you, and thanks to our sangha.
Yes, thank you, and to your own right efforts. And that's how it works. You have integrated the Eightfold Path, and so now you're seeing things from that perspective, which is right view, or at least developing profound right view. And it does change everything. Even not that your trip to Paris was mundane, but even the mundane aspects of life, even a trip to Paris, you see things differently. And yet the experience, this experience is just what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you had a marvelous time. And you're not afraid to admit it. Really, but that's part of it. It's something else that's so, because of this idea of annihilation, some people think, I'm never going to enjoy my life again. You're able to enjoy it at a deeper and more profound level simply because you're mindfully present for what's occurring.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the reward. When I talk about some of the times that reference the Buddha references the culmination of the path, blah 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 blah, the holy life has been lived. But because that has religious connotations, I always change that, because what the Buddha is referring to is a holistic life framed by the Eightfold Path. So a more accurate term, I believe, is an integrated life has been lived, meaning integrated within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Why? Because if we're Dhamma practitioners, that's what the Buddha taught us to do. If we're not interested in it, that's fine. But we should at least be clear that an awakened human being taught this and not that. He taught emptiness for a specific person, purpose. He taught it as more as a verb than as a noun. Just the way it is. Thank you.
If I may also,
please.
I could go on, sorry, Diane. one part of that, in right action, you know, to me, the fifth part of right action is not not taking intoxicants and not being intoxicated.
Yeah.
And I, for the past year and a half, I've not taken intoxicants or been intoxicated. Oh. And it was, I even emailed people I know in France ahead of time to warn them, or to say, I'm not, you know, don't be shocked, I'm not going to drink, because I just don't, and I might, but I just don't think I will at this moment. And because of that, too, first it was thinking, well, how can you have a good time if you're not going to be intoxicated?
Yeah. Isn't that
but
something?
To me, it was more like how I would miss what's going on if I'm intoxicated. I would be, I would miss the moment with you people and with this place I am. And I continued not to be intoxicated there. And to me, it was okay. But you could see the disappointment in people like, please, can you just drink this with me? And I could take, I could let it touch my tongue to have a taste, but I don't want to be intoxicated, you know? So that's just one part of it. It's just part of the path. And I think a very, you know, little piece of the subset of the path, but I think it's a very profound part of the path as well for me. And I think the Buddha stated it.
It absolutely is. And I'm surprised how many so-called modern Buddhists, and, you know, I've been here and been there at different, and it's just so convenient to say, well, you know, the Buddha said no intoxicants, but he really meant, and he meant it for a reason. He meant it so we can maintain our mindfulness, and not in mindfulness in a general sense, so we can remain mindful of the Eightfold Path, and
it helps you stay in right speech.
Everything.
Helps you stay,
You cannot be a Dhamma practitioner. I mean, not to say you never could have a glass of wine or something like that, but you just can't do it if you're a regular drinker. You just can't. Or a regular drug user, for that matter. And that explanation is perfect. I remember when I sobered up because I couldn't drink anymore. I was going to die. Recovered alcoholic. And I remember early on, this is going back quite a few years, people were so worried, the people in early recovery, what am I going to tell people? I can't tell people I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to say when they want to know why I don't drink? And even then I said, I just tell people I don't drink. If they got a problem with it, it's not mine anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the way it is.
They start to take it personally, like that I am judging them for drinking, but it's like you can do what you want.
Yeah.
I'm happy if you enjoy that, but right now I don't choose to.
That's an aspect of ignorance, though, too, that, and it's a little subtle, I don't want to go on too long about it, but a mind that's rooted in ignorance needs a lot of people to do what it's doing to justify it, because it just does. And so anything we do that's different from the norm, and look what's going on in our political climate, anything that's different from what we think it should be is a threat to a self-referential ego self, because it shines too much of a light. If you're not drinking, what must you be thinking of me, because I am? So what?
Yeah.
And everybody, I'll go too deep into that, but that's it. And so the Buddha taught these things for specific reasons. The thing about one of the hindrances is indifference to the Dhamma and to what the Buddha taught. And look at what just that one, the ignorance of indifference. If we weren't indifferent to what the Buddha taught, we'd pay attention to it, wouldn't we? But because we don't even think about the hindrances as important, we'll allow that indifference to what an awakened human being taught to lead to anything else. And it's just that way. So thank you, Kevin. Good to see you tonight. We missed you. Diane, how are you tonight? Again, thank you for being my Uber.
I'm fine. I have nothing to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay,
well, let's... one thing, I don't know if you're interested on it, June 9th, there's a concert up at Wan Dharma Center by something called the Four Nations Ensemble. I understand they're just a marvelous ensemble group, classical music, I'm guessing, you know, what they look like. But they're supposed to be outstanding, and there's a benefit concert to support Wan Dharma Center's expansion. Building another big dorm building. And so I mentioned it to the group while we were on retreat. Everybody thought it was a great idea. Let's get together and come up here. There hasn't been such a big response since then, but I'm just saying if anybody's interested, we want to go, you know, we're trying to organize and see if anybody wants to go. It would mean leaving from here around, unless you want to drive up yourself, around 9:30. The concert starts around 2:00. So that would give us enough, 3 hours up, maybe grab a little lunch or something. But it's, the other, and I didn't really think all about, I don't think any of us did, we were kind of pretty high on the retreat. It is a long day driving, three hours up and 3 hours back, so.
Yeah, well, not impossible.
Yeah. Well, since I don't drive much anywhere, It doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
I think I might want to go up there anyway, figure out a way, if anybody else is going. And there's always the option to spend the night up there, too.
Yeah.
That's too long. So that's just want to put it out there. Let's finish with metta, as we always do. And again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, emitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.